lot of people here to support you, all these guys, I love it.
And we're going to have Kevin come up and share with us tonight.
Kevin, alcoholic. Always wanted to do this. That's what makes you feel like a real speaker. put it down here. Yeah. Can you just... So, my name's Kevin. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety day is January 23rd, 2012. My sponsor is Jason V. His sponsor is Jim Lambert. And it goes so on and so on. My home group originally was a Thursday night men's stag meeting, and you know, a lot of those guys are here, you know. And I changed my home group to Junkyard Dogs for a while because my sponsor moved away, you know, and I'll be getting back to my original home group, you know. So I kind of have two home groups, really. I can do that if I want. In here, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, everything, I sound like a broken record. This is my thing. Lee has his thing, he always says. I have my thing. Is that everything that's good in my life today is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. And most things that are bad in my life are a direct result of me trying to control the show, you know, 90% of the time. I just love this program. You know, I look around the room and I see lots of men that I love and that, you know, that I know love me, you know, and women too, you know. I'm able to learn so many things in life from this program that I'm able to take out of these rooms and into the world, and it's just incredible. The things that I've learned in here in this short, almost 6 years, if I make it another couple months, you know. So what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. 15, 15, and 15. I'm going to try to do that. That never works out. But so I'll start by just touching on my childhood. I got to hit that quick because I could stay like 12 years old for like 35, 40 minutes, you know. We've got no time for recovery. I've done that before. But it all, you know, it all started, you know, my father came home from the Vietnam War when I was about 2. And he left us and went and remarried another woman and went on to raise a family, raise her 3 children. And I was left, me and my little brother, with my mother, who was diagnosed schizophrenic and a drug addict. And things were just completely insane, total chaos. I can't even describe it to you. I mean, it was not good. And we wound up, to make a long story short, when I was 8, my little brother was 5. My mother pretty much she had to give us up because she couldn't take care of us. You know, she was sick. She was very sick, and that was a very traumatic experience for me. That's all right here, clear as a bell. I won't go into it. But so long story short, we wind up in receiving homes, and then we wind up in emergency foster care, where they take foster kids for 6 months at a time and then reevaluate their situation. And then either you'd go on to another foster care or wherever they're going to put you. But they kept re-upping us every 6 months. And this family decided to stop taking foster children and just to raise my little brother and I, which was cool. You know, overall, I think they were pretty good, you know, people, my foster parents. They didn't drink. Never smoked cigarettes, didn't do anything like that. My foster dad was like a Korean War hero, really. Had all these medals. He was like a man's man, you know. You work hard, you be tough, you don't cry, you don't show emotion, you just dig in and do the work. You know, he had like leather hands. He was just a really strong man, you know. And my mom was, she was a little nuts, pretty abusive. There was a lot of abuse, a lot of physical abuse there. And there's a lot of work. My little brother and I did a lot of work on, we lived way out in the country, and we poured concrete all over our property. We laid rock around our ranch house. We just constantly working. And my little brother and I were like the little bastard stepchildren. It felt like the little worker bees, you know, while their kids are off just running them up, doing whatever, you know. And they were older. These foster brothers of mine are older and bikers. And you know, they used to do our, when we were young, they used to get us really high and laugh at us when we'd have, you know, anxiety attacks, and feed us alcohol when we were really young, and it was just a total chaos. Family get-togethers, my older brothers would get completely wasted, and then my dad would beat the crap out of them. And the whole family would be just, like, standing there in shock while he's in the backyard beating up three men, you know. It was just crazy. It was total chaos, man. It was nuts. And then, so, during all this time, I didn't feel like a part of, like, you always hear us alcoholics saying that. We didn't feel a part of, we felt different, you know. I really didn't feel a part of, because I wasn't a real child. I was just a foster kid, you know. And that was, like, ingrained in me. So I really had that feeling from the get-go, you know. Even though, you know, to be fair, they would tell us, you know, you're our children. We love you, you know. I want you to know that we love you and you're our kids just as much as the others. But we were treated differently, you know. And, of course, I'm an alcoholic, so I really felt like I was treated differently, right? And, you know, this went on for a while, and there was another, you know, that family had a dark little secret of, you know, there was a lot of other things going on. There was a lot of, my little brother and I were, we were molested a lot for years, probably from the age of 8 to like 13 years old for me and my little brother. And I remember this, the helpless feeling I would have of just watching it happen to my little brother, and I couldn't do anything about it. Watching him get beat, and I couldn't do anything about it. I would just stand there in fear, just total fear, afraid to do anything. Until one day I finally snapped, and things changed from that day forward. But I remember one time my mom was beating my little brother, and I stepped in and I went toe to toe with her. I started boxing her. I stood up to her and was gonna box her. She beat the crap out of me. It was funny. And then my dad came home, beat the crap out of me for fighting with my mom, you know. But things changed from then on, you know. And as far as that went, and I learned a lot of, you know, I learned coping skills of, you know, things like with sexuality and with weird, you know, things like with all the molestation that went through my head as a kid, you know. Am I gay? How come I didn't tell nobody about this? How come I didn't stop this? You know, why didn't I do anything about it? Why didn't I fight? But my coping mechanism was to pretend it wasn't happening and just not say anything to anybody out of fear, you know. It was fear. It was total fear. You know, I know that now. I didn't know that then. I was just a kid. You know, when I think back on those times, I was a victim then. When I was a child, I was a victim. I'm not a victim anymore. But then I was. And it's okay. And I understand that now. It's okay. You know? And I just like to share those things because maybe, you know, a lot of us have things like that. I know I've sponsored a lot of guys, and I've been sponsored, and I've heard things from other people, you know? And this kind of stuff happens to us, you know. And we talk about alcoholism as it's usually a deeper sense, you know. It's like a remedy, a medicine for our deeper issues and deeper things that we have going on, you know. And that's what alcohol became for me. It was a medicine for all that kind of stuff, you know. Early on, weed and drugs and alcohol, anything I could really get into my system. This helped me learn. It helped me feel that sense of comfort and ease that we talk about, you know. I remember the first time I drank, I was really young, and we broke into some barn of the neighbor's property, and we pounded some, like, 30-year-old bottle of, I don't know what the heck it was, wine or champagne, and it made me sick, and I threw up and thought it was disgusting. I didn't like it at all, you know. But a big old sack of the weed, I love that, you know. I had no problems with that and did that for a long time. And once I became a teenager, I met my high school sweetheart, like ninth grade, and I got completely involved with her and clung to her like she was my higher power, my lower power, my middle power, and my everything, right? It just felt like I was like falling off a cliff, and there's a branch hanging out, and I was hanging on to it, keep from falling into the abyss, and that branch was her. She was my everything, you know, just for my situation. It's just the way it went. And I got out of that. I left that foster home when I was 16 years old, and I went and moved in with her and worked on this dairy farm. And I was 16 years old, and she was 14 years old, and I was sleeping in her bedroom with her. And I was doing milking the cows and milking the farmer's daughter. I was doing it's exactly what was going on, man. The dad, he was an alcoholic, and he didn't care. It was bizarre, man. I think about that now, and I'm thinking that is insane. Because I have children now, and I can't even believe that, you know. And I lived there in that house, slept in the bedroom with her, and he would wake me up every morning like 5 a.m., you know, Kevin, go get the cows in. You know, and I'd get up, and I'd go get the cows, 200 head of cattle, and milk these freaking cows, and clean out the milk barn, and then feed the calves, and then feed the cows, and then feed the horses, and then I'd go to school. Then I'd come home from school, and I'd do it all over again. And through my teenage years, you know, I played guitar, and one of my foster brothers was a guitar player and a biker, and I thought he was really cool and wanted to be just like him, you know. And this lady bought me this girl I was living with, her mother bought me my first guitar. And I learned how to play the guitar and was always in a little band in high school and always had music in my life, you know. And when I became 18, when I barely graduated from high school, I don't even know how that happened. Back in 1985, you didn't really have to show up and somehow you graduated. I don't know how, it's not like that anymore, but, the only thing I had going that I thought I could do was go into the military. Because college wasn't, you know, an option. Who's going to pay for me to go to college? I'm not going to college, the only thing I thought I had was a way out was to go in the military. So I went in the military and I went into the Navy. And I learned, you know, that's probably when my drinking really, really took off, man. Because, you know, there's two things I learned about the Navy. That was naked women and whiskey. And that was, you know, strip clubs and whiskey. You know, I just fell right into that crowd with those people, you know. And that's what I did, man. That's what I did. And I drank. And I remember, you know, like a lot of us share, you know, that we take that first drink. You know, I remember that drink was going to, I just remember the warming feeling that would come over me, that sense of ease and comfort, that feeling of, everything's okay. I could be happy now. I could have fun now. I could be joyful. Like that song. And it was just that feeling, you know. And I always, and when I drank, I'd shoot for that mark. I'd want to obtain that feeling, you know, that feeling where I'm okay and where I'm happy. And anything I would do, I'd have to, you know, you got to bring that feeling with you. You got to somehow get that feeling to be happy. Because I had no idea how to be happy in my own skin. I had no idea how to be happy without alcohol, you know. And it made me feel that way. The problem is I would always overshoot that mark, you know. I'd shoot for that, you know, I want to be it right here and get that perfect buzz and feel great and good and enjoy my night. But I just shoot right past that buzz. And butt naked. That was my thing. I mean, sorry, but that's part of my story. I wound up naked in the most inappropriate places all the time. And it was crazy, you know. But that when I was a young man, I just gotten out of the Navy, and that woman that I married, you know, I married my high school sweetheart, and she just came home within like a 15-minute period, just came home and said, I don't love you anymore, packed a bag, and boom, was gone. And, man, I went into like a 2-year pity party. I mean, that was a huge pity party, and I was just so, that just rocked my whole world. And then I just took off, man. First thing I did is like any alcoholic, good alcoholic would do is I pulled the Geographic right off the bat. And I was down in San Diego and I was like, I gotta move. I gotta get out of here. It's these people, it's this place, it's these memories, is this where she is? I gotta go. Boom. Went to Northern California. And immediately got into a rock band and just, you know, had the big hair, makeup, all this crazy stuff. And then for 2 years, it was just like drugs, sex, and rock and roll, you know. It was, but alcohol, you know, lots and lots and lots of alcohol. And I, for a year, I didn't even work. I just sold drugs and played in a rock band. And it was a fun year. It was a good year. I had a lot of fun, man. But I was chasing after this feeling. I was chasing after. I wanted to get that. I was chasing, trying to find what I had in her in somebody else, right? I was trying to fix an inside problem with outside stuff, like we always talk about in here. And it does not work. You know, it just doesn't work. It just left me with a very empty, lonely, just horrible existence. I was just a shell of a man, you know? And it was an awful, awful feeling, you know? I didn't much want to live back then either, you know? And so I did what every good alcoholic would do, is I pulled another Geographic, you know? I had to move again, you know? I got to move, you know? Boom, came back down to Southern California. And because my real cousin had called me, and this was my real blood cousin, my real mother's sister's son. And he lived in Thousand Oaks. And he said, you need to be with your real family. Come back down to Southern California. You can live with me. Well, I got there and soon discovered that he was a very huge cocaine dealer in Thousand Oaks, you know. So his house was just a giant party all the time. And we just drank and drank and drank and did drugs. And it was just, it was bad, you know, for a while. And so I had to move again. So I moved back to Northern California again, you know. See, and the problem is, you know, like how many of us have heard this? You know, I look around the room and there's a lot of people who got time. It's just like, I brought me with me every time. Every time I went, I brought me with me. And that was the problem. It was me. It wasn't where I lived. It wasn't the people. It was me. You know, and I went back up to Northern California. Things didn't work out there again. And I moved again. I was just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I was back down here again and got back in a band. You know, I was in this band, and we were really good, and we rehearsed 5 nights a week, and we were playing with all these other bands in Hollywood and all over the place. And long story short, record deals started to come in, but I passed them up and quit the band out of fear, because I was afraid that if I was away from my wife, that she would cheat on me and leave me, like my first wife did. I'm married again now. I left that out. When I moved back down the last time, I met my last wife, and out of fear, I passed up on a lot of things that I you know, could have done, because I was scared. I was just, my life was running on total fear, you know, and I really had those crazy thoughts, like, if I leave, I go on the road. First off, I'm not 18 years old anymore. I can't roll around with you knuckleheads in some van and, you know, act stupid, and my wife's, she's going to cheat on me and leave me. And so I passed up a lot of opportunity, and these other bands that we were playing with, they got record deals, and they're like, a lot of them are really super famous today. That like sent me into this tailspin of depression and just more drinking, more drugs, more depression, more pity party. It just got crazy. And this whole time I'm married. I have two beautiful sons from this woman, and I've kept a job. Okay, so I've kept a job through all this, and I had a good job. And I made lots of money, and I had a job that afforded me lots of free time. And just throughout the years, you know, everything was a party, right? Everything just seemed normal. Everything was, you know, we're going camping. We got to get beer. We got to get some outside issues. You know, we got to get some other stuff to go with us because it's going to be a party and we're going to have fun. And that kind of stuff just cruised along okay, you know. So I thought, right? And then, like the book tells us, is selfishness, self-seeking is the root of our troubles, right? You know, and while that's cruised along, I have no idea how selfish and self-seeking I am. You know, a lot of times in sobriety, I have no idea how selfish and self-seeking I am. But it's pointed out to me a lot today, you know. But, you know, so life was cruising along like that. And slowly but surely, alcohol was taking over my life. And I had every reason to not believe that because I had a good job, you know. I had a good job. I made good money. I owned a house. I had two kids. I got a wife. I'm making over $100,000 a year. My cousin, who was a coke dealer, is now street level. He's banging meth. He's sticking needles in his neck. He's pushing a shopping cart around. He's a homeless dude in Thousand Oaks. You know, I'm living the life. I slowly but surely turn into somebody that I cannot stand, you know. I couldn't look in the mirror. You know, I would look in the mirror, I would cry. I would just cry because I was ashamed of myself. I was ashamed of the stuff I was doing. I was ashamed the way I was living. And I had a lot of guilt from things that I've done, you know. And it just got really, really ugly, slowly but surely, you know. And during that time, while things are just still like slowly cruising along, my cousin, who's street level, found this program, got into a treatment center, got sober, went to college, went to school, he works at treatment centers, became an alcohol and drug counselor, and he works in these big dollar treatment centers down in along the coast down there, Malibu. Thank you. And, you know, he's doing the deal. And he gets to where he's got like 6 years, about like where I'm at right now, you know. And then I hit a point where I got to a point where even when I was sober, I was completely insane. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like I was doing stuff that was shameful and causing me a great deal of pain and guilt when I was stone cold sober. You know, my thinking, you know, we talk about the insanity, you know, because, you know, I suffer from a spiritual malady, obsession of the mind, and an allergy of the body, right? And that just isn't just when I'm drunk. That's like all the time. You know, my thinking becomes distorted. My perception is completely off base. I'm not making any decisions that make any kind of sense. And on one hand, I think that the most important thing to me in my whole life is my kids, because I want to give them the kind of life that I didn't have, right? I had raised in this foster home and all this horrible stuff happened. I'm going to give my life, my kids, a good life, and I'm going to love them and show them what love is and what it is to be part of a good family and show them all the love I can. But I'm spending all day, every day at a freaking beach down in Santa Barbara when I should be working and just being a weirdo. I got to the point where I was, I had an unmarked company vehicle. I was a supervisor of a bunch of guys and I would bust out my work. Whatever I had to do is get it done as fast as I possibly could so I could get some alcohol, get some Vicodin, and get to the beach. And there I would hang out. And there I would hide out. There I would isolate. You know, and it got weird, man. It got weird. My thinking got weird. I was a sick dude. Just put it that way to keep everything in a general, sharing in a general way. He's smiling over here. He's heard my fist step. but was not pretty. And I, you know, put it this way. What happened was I, you know, I had this job of like almost 20 years. I'm making over 100 grand a year, right? I have a company vehicle. I got great insurance. I own a house. I got two kids, a wife, and I lose my job. I lose my job for being naked on a beach during working hours. And I have to come home and tell my wife this. And that was the beginning of the end for me right there, you know. That was kind of what happened. You know, that was an accumulation of a lot of this stuff that that sent me over the edge, you know. It's funny now. It's really funny now, you know, when I think back. But, man, when that happened, it was not funny. It was not funny. Especially when my wife, I could just remember my wife collapsing on the garage floor, just crying and just, you know, and I knew that just my behavior and the way I was living caused, you know, her this much pain and this much fear. And she was going through, you know, I had put her, well, really I say that, but she put her through school. You know, I helped. But it was a scary time, and all of a sudden, who was a provider, did not have a job. You know, thank God she did. But I put that woman through hell. So if I think back all the years and the things that I was doing and the way I was acting, it was not cool. It's just a sobering reminder of how selfish and self-seeking we can be, you know, even when we don't realize it, you know. So what happened was I lose my job, and at that point I feel like I got like a dark cloud over me. Like in my industry, it's a small industry, and people are going to be hearing about this, you know. Other people are going to hear about this. I'm not going to be able to get a job anywhere, you know. And I got a job like a month later. I went to another large company that was our competitor, and boom, I was working again. Bam, for 2 years working again. Then a dream job comes in, they start the hiring process with me. I go through all the background investigation and everything, and they just go, boom, we have to stop the hiring process on you. And they wouldn't tell me why. But I knew why in my head. I knew why, you know. And then from that point on, I just thought, life's over. I'm done. There's just like a dark cloud over me. I'm driving around in my work truck just crying all the time. I have no idea why. I'm thinking about killing myself all the time. I'm wanting to like think, you know, run my truck off the road. I wind up in a place where I just, you know, fast forward, just the incomprehensible demoralization, right? Isn't that cute when we hear newcomers say that, you know? I just wind up in that spot on the garage floor with a gun in one hand and a bottle of whiskey in the other, you know? I just came, at that point in my life, I had whiskey bottles hidden all over the garage, you know? I'd look both ways, 6 o'clock in the morning, make sure no one could see me, and I'd pull one out and just pound it like I was pounding a Coors Light. I mean, I would just turn that bottle up and just, that's the way I was drinking at the end. You see, I was cruising along like this, like this, like this, and then just went, phew, just right off an edge, you know? And life just went, man, when I went down hard and fast from having everything to nothing. I mean, just like that, you know? And it was scary how fast it went. And it was scary how emotionally I just lost it. I just didn't want to live. I want to die, you know. And that cousin of mine, my wife, called him to help me, you know. She reached out to him. And the first thing he told her was, you know, get the gun away from him and secure, you know, put that in the safe or hide it or do something when he's not around it. Because I wasn't going to shoot myself. I don't got enough balls to shoot myself. That was all drama. I just wanted attention, you know, help me, you know. But it was just crazy to see the example of him going from a street level person to what he had turned into today. And how many times he reached out to me, and how many times I just, you're like a hobo, dude. You don't know nothing, you know. I'm the one that's got it going on. You just got sober. You know, and how often I just turned away from his help, you know. And he spent all day calling treatment facilities, trying to find places for me, you know. And he got a gal on the phone, and this is where God started to work in my life, you know. Before I just want to back up just a little bit. Before, when I was, you know, doing all this stuff and going to the beaches and hanging out there and isolating and drinking and doing all the crazy crap I was doing, I would drop to my knees and pray to God all the time. Please let me stop. Just please help me. Get me out of here. Help me leave. Help me go home. Help. Constantly. I was doing that all the time. I was just so sick and insane. And you know, he wound up helping me, not in my time, not on my terms, not the way I wanted it to go down, but it went down all right, you know. So my cousin got a hold of this gal, and he knew I was in a really bad spot, and she said that, well, we just opened up a new treatment facility, and if you could get him here by tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. in the morning, we could take him, if you can get him on a plane. And we have a group starting Monday morning. It was Sunday, you know, and she said, do you have any idea where Santa Barbara is? And he was like, yeah, it's where we live, you know. And so wound up, my wife took me there the next morning. I agreed to go. I called the number that he asked me to call and talk to, and I talked to this intake gal that was, you know, it was my first experience besides outside of him with you people, really. There was like this warm, kind voice on the other side just showing me love, and I was telling her all this crazy stuff I was doing, you know, and I thought, well, how can this lady, like, why isn't she, like, hanging up on me and telling me to go away, you freaking weirdo, you know, but, you know, and I went to this treatment facility, and man, I needed that bad, and that really helped me. It helped me so much to get a start on this thing. And at that point, I was just so broken. You know, I was so broken, and hurting, and not wanting to live. And I discovered some things about myself in there that was just so, you know, painful and. It was just amazing, you know. It was an amazing experience for me, and so when I arrived here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want what you guys had, you know. I really did. I was willing. I came here willing and wanting to do this thing. It took me a long time to get here, and I ignored a lot of all the freaking red lights, stop signs, everything God was putting in my path. I just blew right through that stuff for a long time. Until I was 45 years old and finally gave up, you know. And when I got here, I was willing, you know. And you guys, thank God I found you guys, you know. See, I always had a belief in God. And I know this program, I've come to learn that it's for me, you know, and I've heard others say it too, it's about becoming closer to God or your God. Your higher power. I mean, our primary purpose is obviously to stay sober and to help others to achieve sobriety, right? But how do we do that, right? I know that I have a daily reprieve based upon my spiritual condition. So, right, I have to feed my soul spiritually. I have to become closer to God. I have to step two, step three, right? Step six, step seven. You know, I got to constantly step 10, 11, and 12. I have to constantly work the steps and constantly try to get closer to my higher power through prayer and meditation and acts of selflessness and being service to others, because the root of our problems is selfishness and self-seeking, right? And so there was a time where I turned towards the church, but the church, you know, oh, that's great, and I love the church, and I go to church now, and I play on the worship team, because now today, music, it gets to be something where I serve my higher power through music rather than serving myself, in my self-seeking behavior, you know. So that feels really good for me. For me, that's something that's really healthy for me, you know. But okay, all that, right, done. Cool, I got 15 minutes for what it's like now. I did it. So what it's like now. The whole 15 minutes. All right, listen up. No. So what it's like now. You know, what do I do today to stay sober, right? Obviously, service, right? Got to go to meetings, got to show up at meetings, got to have the fellowship, you know, the unity service, recovery, I mean, the steps on the wall, you know. I got to work the steps, right? I don't just blow through the steps like it's a race and I'm done, woohoo, give me my certificate, I'm out, right? I got to work the steps on a daily basis, constantly. I've made a lot of freaking mistakes in recovery. I've caused a lot of wreckage in recovery. Made a lot of mistakes in recovery. I heard one person say, you know, the thing of it is that I want my mistakes to be new mistakes, not the same mistakes. That's the idea, right? Because I know I'm going to make mistakes, right? I just don't want to keep making the same mistakes over and over and over. I want to learn from them, and hopefully my next mistake is going to be a new one. And I could learn from it and grow from it, you know. Well, before I get into that, I call my sponsor every day. Call my sponsor every freaking day, sometimes two times a day, sometimes three times a day. Not because I need to and I'm in trouble. Oh, God, I need your help all day. No. It's just we become best friends. And the first call of the day every day is, hey, bro, just checking in. Just checking in. I'm an alcoholic. I need to be accountable to somebody. I'm just checking in. Period. That's it. It's humbling. It's, you know, puts me in my right place that I need to be. So I'm not, because that's me. You know, otherwise I'll get in that place where I don't need to be. Why do I need to be checking into somebody? You check in. You know? That's where I'll go if I don't keep myself humble, you know? Ego, man. Ego is not your amigo, right? Right? I mean, I got a lot of ego. Ego is, man, whew. And then I don't realize it. I usually never realize it. I don't know when I'm acting out in ego. Someone has to tell me. Someone has to point it out usually. You know, I don't just, my brain don't work that way. Maybe some of you do, you know. Maybe some of you can go, oh man, this ego, hold up, I got to change this, you know. I'm not there yet. I need my sponsor to help me, you know. Like, hey, bro, how are those actions, how are those falling in line with your Christian beliefs? How is that behavior helping your spiritual growth? I hate that one. You know, and when I was in it with my ex, my wife, God bless that woman, you know, I was with her for 22 years. This last year I went through a divorce. She divorced me. I didn't want a divorce. You know, I love that woman. I still love that woman. I'm going to love that woman for the rest of my life. I put that woman through hell. Another thing I realized is I have to accept the wreckage that I've created, you know. She can't get past it. Maybe she's not willing to do the work. Oh, well, that's not my deal, you know. That's her deal. You know, but I put her through the wreckage. I have to accept that, you know. She left me. She wanted a divorce from me. I moved her into her new house. I mean, who does that? People in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, because you guys taught me. That wasn't me. I learned that here. You guys taught me that, you know. Well, Anthony helped move her in her new house, too. My sponsor helped me, you know, and she let me stay at her house for 15 days until my house closed. And we're still friends today, and we still talk, and it's okay. You know, I don't, it doesn't have to be a war, you know. Although, I was hurt really bad, and I've made all kinds of mistakes, and I've lashed out, you know, at times. You know, I've done those texts, you know, I just don't understand, I love you, why does it have to be this way? And my sponsor's like, why did you did it again? you know, I guess you're going to keep doing that until you get enough pain that you're going to stop doing that, right? And, you know, it's just, I'm not perfect. I just, you know, I just got to keep working through it. I got to keep telling on myself. I got to keep being accountable to somebody that's going to help me, you know? I mean, we were talking about that the other night. Me and Lisa were talking about that. You know, some people subscribe to the thing. You know, you can do whatever you want to do as long as you're willing to suffer the consequences. No, that's not the way I sponsor guys. That's not the way I'm sponsored. It's like, dude, you better stop that behavior, what you're doing, or you're gonna drink. And if you continue that behavior, I'm not going to be able to sponsor you any longer. Period. But I knew he'd still have to because his sponsor would make him keep sponsoring me. But I got told that. You know, I got told that and I was like, oh man, he's serious. You know? And that scared me because I've been a long time with my sponsor, you know, and he's helped me through a lot of stuff, you know? You know, and then Lee helped me through my first year, you know, and a lot of these men here, you know, and sponsoring guys, and Jesse, and Anthony, and guys in, that I've got to be a part of their lives, and the guys that have been a part of my lives, man, it's just, it's amazing. This last year, man, oh my God, it's been rough, man. Going through that divorce and the stuff I did, you know, the things that I preach to guys that I sponsor, you don't do this, stay away from that, blah, 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 and then look at me, I go and do it. You know, and I'm not perfect, I make mistakes, you know, and I suffered the consequences, man. But the thing is I ultimately wound up listening to my sponsor and the men around me and the people who were telling me what I should be doing and what I was doing wrong and the reasons why. I ultimately snapped out and did what they told me to do, you know, and I'm still sober today. Still sober today because of it, and I don't know that I would be. You know, through a lot of those actions and things I was doing, the real person at risk to drinking was me. You know, and thank God I listened and learned and developed a habit of taking direction. That's why we do it. We develop these habits of taking direction from our sponsors and learning, that, you know, to do this program. And I got to do that constantly, man. I just got to do that. 10, 11, and 12. Are you resentful? Well, I don't know. You don't know you're resentful, right? Damn. Dang it. 10, 11, 12, you know. Pray to God, you know. Give it up to God, you know. Write out that 10th step. Get into service to somebody else. Pray, meditate, all those things. I got to constantly do. I got to constantly keep up on that stuff. It's otherwise, I just, you know, we're alcoholics. We got great forgetters, man. And we see it all around us all the time when someone goes out. It don't matter how much time you got. It don't. I mean, you got a lot of time. Yeah, you got a lot of experience in the program. You've experienced all this longevity and these things in your sobriety. That maybe someone that doesn't have as much time as you has had the opportunity to experience. But if you stop doing your program, you're going to get drunk too. Just like any of us, you know. That's why we got to stay on it, you know. And that, that's been pounded into my head so many times, you know. And I've seen it. What's the first thing you hear out of someone's mouth after they relapse, when they come back, after they've had time? Stop going to meetings. Stop calling my sponsor. Stop being a service. And finally, I just drink, you know. And then they're back. I mean, tell me if you heard something different, because that's what I keep hearing. I know I'm nuts, but that's what I keep hearing. But this gets kind of controversial, but I'm you know, you talk about, you know, I had a lot of, like, outside issues and different things, drugs, sex, things like that. But then I think, is sex really an outside issue? Is it really? I mean, there's a whole inventory for it in our four-step, you know? There's pages just dedicated to it. I don't think I've ever sponsored a man that didn't have any sort of an issue there, you know? And it just really, for me, it just shines a spotlight on how selfish and self-seeking we could be sometimes, you know. And I know I'm sick with that, and I always need help with that, and my sponsor always helps me with things like that, you know. But I'll end with this, you know. My God and my higher power is, I'm like a Christian dude, right? Jesus Christ is my higher power, straight up. I mean, some people are, you shouldn't say that in a meeting. Well, then don't tell me your higher power is a doorknob. I don't say nothing to you, you know, or a light bulb or whatever. I don't care. That's your higher power. Jesus Christ is my higher power. But it's different, you know. It's different now. It's not. It's more of, I have a more of a broader view, more open and all inclusive, just like you guys taught me to be here. Just like you taught me how to be a man, how to be a father, how to be a friend, how to take my eyes from here to here, how to look a grown man in the eye and say, you know what, bro, I love you, man. Thank you. I appreciate you. I love you. You know, thank you. How to look a grown man in the eye and set healthy boundaries for myself. Hey, man, don't treat me like that. I don't appreciate that. You know what? That hurts my feelings when you talk to me like that. Instead of, nah, I'm just going to let this go and let this go and let this go. Let this go and then explode like I used to. Right. Just all those little things I learned here in alcohol. And why am I learning this stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous? And we just supposed to be a bunch of people that just stop drinking? No, I learned all this stuff here, man. It's awesome. You know? And me being, I'm not like a normal Christian dude. I'm not your garden variety Christian dude. I know I got like my worship leader and some of the other pastors at my church on my Facebook page. And I see the stuff I post and they probably look at that and go, oh, crap. I ain't commenting on that. But then they comment on the nice good stuff, you know. It's okay. It's just my God is my higher power is different to me now. And I'm open to other people's belief systems. I'm not so judgmental today. Like, this is the only way or you're going to burn in hell. I mean, I'm just not like that. I just view it as there's one God and we all have our own path. Our own pathway and wherever that is for all of us, that's whatever it is. It's none of my business what yours is. You know, and I've learned that here too. And I'm more at peace with my higher power and with that view today, you know. It's cool. And you know what? And I'll end with this is that, like, for me, when Jesus comes back this time, he's going to roll up on a Harley. He's not going to be on a donkey. He's going to roll up on a big, gnarly Harley. He's going to get off. He's going to be all cool, dude. He's going to walk up, and he's going to give me a big hug and look me in the eye and said, you know what, man? I love you. And you know what? That happens almost daily in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks for letting me share.
Kevin.
Do we have any announcements from the floor?